So a quick announcement. When you pointed out that I had my labels wrong on the schematics in the demo file. So the footprint is correct. Got labeled on the top cell screen what all the pin connections are. These two were swapped in the schematic symbol. I've updated the files, updated the libraries on the website. You can re-download and overwrite that library, that footprint. I believe this is only true for the single connector, not the one that has all eight, or swap these pins. Okay. Questions on that? Okay. Other questions related to previous material or to the tiny box challenge? Is everybody starting to submit for AFV? Should be. Make sure that you get that all verified by 9 a.m. Wednesday. You know, a few warnings. Come and tell me, well, I submitted an AFV Tuesday at midnight and they didn't get back to me until Wednesday morning. That's going to happen if you take that time route. Make sure you get things in and are submitting to make sure that they can manufacture early so you have time to turn around and if there's issues, fix them and get a set of files to pass. Okay. Well, if nothing else, we'll move on. We're going to take a bit of a step back today and look at where we stand in terms of what we've done with our converter design so far, what kind of the merits and issues are with the ZVS approach we've been taking, and you know, what we did previously with our state plane analysis, which we'll move back to, and really still apply to everything we did with AC link converters. We're still operating our switching transitions in the same way. So have an inductance that resonates with our output caps, gets a CVS. Right? So looking back at just our old ZVS quasi-square wave buck, we took a normal buck converter, and what we wanted to do was integrate these parasitics into the operation of the converter and eliminate the losses associated with hard switching those. The way we did that is we reduced the value of L instead of some filter element. We made this a resonant element LR. We look at what we have for waveforms, V switch and IR. Now in our operation, IR looks something like this. V switch would be something like this. Okay. So we had a number of trade-offs. We had things that we addressed and things that we didn't. Here's my average output current IL. In order to put myself into this mode of operation, I had to allow much larger ripple, much larger current stresses in all of my semiconductor devices. The advantage of doing so was really in this transition that I get my currents to go down, crossing zero and going negative, and charge and discharge these caps. So at the beginning of class, we went through and looked at switching transitions and what sort of loss mechanisms occur in those. And we had some that we analyzed in detail and some that we kind of mentioned. And I want to look back at those and see which we've actually addressed here and to what degree. If I look at switching losses, which could or do occur in some sort of a PWM converter, I have my COSS CD losses due to hard switching those, due to shorting out those capacitors, either directly shorting out and dissipating their energy or hard charging them through a resistance. And that's one that we addressed. We more or less just got rid of that by going to the soft switching. Pull that energy out, put it into the inductor. And that's going to have negligible residual loss in this operation. And we went through and we talked about overlap loss. And we have overlap at turn on and overlap at turn off of the FET. So if we look at when things actually operate, my buck operation, I have my FET on until this point where I turn the FET off and then turn it back on here. I've intentionally drawn these waveforms a bit more realistic than I do sometimes, and that I've got a much longer dead time at this transition where I'm close to zero current and slowly traversing through this resonance. A much shorter one here where I have my peak current, which is just going to blast in and quickly move my voltage. Okay. So at turn on, at this time, my switch node voltage has already risen up. It's reached the input VG. And if I'm a little late, it's even turned on the body diode of that FET. So when I turn on, voltage across the FET is zero. And my overlap loss at turn on should be more or less eliminated. Okay. At turn off, I still have a large voltage across the FET. Okay, I have current going through it. I could potentially still have some overlap losses. Okay. I've likely decreased them, but this we analyzed earlier, looking at the ratio of power stage current and capacitance to gate driver current and capacitance. If my gate driver is not fast enough, I'll still have significant overlap loss. If it's fast enough, I'll have minimal overlap loss at turn off, but it's still there. And this is a tough transition for it because I've got the peak current, the voltage is moving as fast as can be for my given topology. And I've got to drive much faster than that voltage moves in order to reduce those turnoff losses. So those will still be present, whether negligible or not, depends on my gate drive design compared to my power stage. Okay. So I'm going to talk about reverse recovery. Drawn this as a Schottky. But if it was a silicon diode, what have I done with reverse recovery? For the sake of generality, we'll discuss this even though it looks like a Schottky in my schematic. So reverse recovery, again, is one that should be greatly reduced, but not eliminated. So my diode is conducting through this interval. Its current ramps down to zero slowly. Once it hits zero, if it's an ideal Schottky, it shuts off. If it's a silicon diode, it's going to extend a little bit past zero to deplete that minority carrier charge, then shut off, then begin resonating. So if I did have reverse recovery, my waveforms here would continue a little bit further, then resonate. And this would be kind of my QR. The silicon diode. Now we talked about so reverse recovery, the magnitude of QR depends heavily on the forward current and the ramp rate at turn off, as well as temperature and some other things. Here, by going to this mode of operation, I've significantly reduced the ramp rate at turn off, right? I'm slowly ramping down my inductor current, which is my diode current, over this entire interval, rather than keeping it constant and then ripping it off right when I turn the FET back on. Okay. So this should be greatly reduced, but still exists. Then, let's see, we have QG type losses, power supply coming from my auxiliary gate drivers to charge and discharge the gate. This one, I've really done nothing with, right? This one is just whatever it was before. If I'm at the same switching frequency solely by changing my power stage operation, I have no impact on these losses. Where these are going to be problematic is as I move forward. So by eliminating these, that may allow me to move up to higher switching frequency. May have been my goal in going to a soft switch topology. But as I go up in switching frequency, these are going to become more significant. And we'll look at a few more loss elements, but that's really one of the main points I'm trying to drive at with this slide, is that what we've done is we've eliminated some dominant loss mechanisms. And if we stick with the same design, it probably gets us close to negligible switching losses. But if we're pushing forward, if we're trying to optimize, minimize passes, move up to higher switching frequency, we've eliminated the dominant loss mechanisms. Then we go up in switching frequency and non-dominant loss mechanisms become significant. We're uncovering lower order loss mechanisms. Okay. Other things to think about. Body diode conduction. So if this really depends on my timing, if I'm a little bit late in turning on the MOSFET, then my current's going to go up through the body diode of the main FET. That's going to introduce extra losses that are fundamentally a conduction type loss. It's current through a diode, but it occurs for a fixed portion of the period. It's going to be BF times I times whatever time over TS, which is then going to look like a switching type loss. It's proportional to switching frequency. Okay. So that really depends on my timing. Again, here doesn't necessarily change much, but going to become more significant as I go to higher switching frequency because I'm maybe limited in the resolution that I can achieve with this gate drive. It's going to become a larger portion of the switching period in which I'm having this diode conduction. Okay. Next one is one that we have mentioned on the side, but haven't really focused on, and that's any losses related to parasitic loop inductance. So we've really focused in terms of parasitics on shunt capacitance with my switching devices, but any inductance in series with this power loop, anything really in this loop here, is somewhat the dual of my CDS and CD capacitances. Those CDS and CD, I didn't want to be shorting them out. L pair, I don't want to open a switch in series with that when it has current flowing through it. And that's going to be particularly an issue this transition, where I have full current flowing up through my FET, and then I open the switch, go through this transition, whatever current was left in that parasitic inductance, if I did my ideal waveforms at the input, it would kind of drop down to zero, be decoupled. Any residual energy in that parasitic inductance is going to ring out and be lost, cause ringing in my waveforms, over voltage, over current. It's going to be the dual. It's going to look like 1/2 Li squared type losses that dump out because I'm opening a switch in series with that inductor. Okay. So this one I haven't addressed at all. And then last thing, a bit more qualitative, is DVDT induced. Call it gate drive distortion. And what I mean by this is really that Miller effect. And if I have very high DVDT drain to source of the power device, same DVDT is going to get applied gate to drain. It's going to inject current back into the gate driver, potentially turn my set back on after I try to turn it off, causing extra switching losses, causing an extra switching action that could be, you know, full overlap type losses because it occurs at a time that I didn't intend to have a switching action. Right. So these things, not addressed by going to zero voltage switching, this quality square wave approach, they're not inherently made any worse, but if I am trying to push up in switching frequency, they will become worse. And if I think that this allows me, okay, I got rid of overlap and COSS, so I can go arbitrarily high in switching frequency, magnetics are ideal, caps are ideal. Well, these things are now going to become dominant loss mechanisms. Even though in my 10 kilohertz buck, these were negligible even if I did nothing, I've, by getting rid of one and two, I've kind of revealed them as now my dominant switching loss mechanisms. Okay. Yeah.
For kind of modeling, especially for the therapeutic inductance, do you recommend trying to
So there are degrees of complexity versus accuracy on that one. So a loop size estimate combined with, for whatever package you have on your power devices, data sheets will often report what that parasitic inductance is, or if they're standard packages, it's well known, would be kind of the fastest and least accurate, better than doing nothing about it, at least accurate method of incorporating it. Next up would be something more like finite element analysis, running a model of it to figure out exactly what we think that inductance is. In truth, once you get into that type of analysis, there's not a great answer. Even if you run the finite element analysis and get what you think is exactly your parasitic conductance, or even go out and measure it on a circuit board, a single value is likely not all that accurate there because you're looking at dynamics in the tens of megahertz where the inductance, the series resistance are going to be nonlinear with respect to frequency. So, and it's more of a conceptual thing to analyze of how is this going to affect my circuit? What's the relative magnitude of the significance and how can I do something about it rather than let me get an accurate number for over voltage or switching loss out of that. Does that make sense? Okay, so eliminate these. I get to go way higher in switching frequency, and now I've got other problems coming into play. And look at how to address these over the next few lectures. But I first want to kind of prep with, okay, with all of this in mind, what would I really like out of my converter? What would I like these switching waveforms to be that could lead to the best kind of high frequency candidate converter? And so if I look at, for my active switch, VDS and ID was kind of my wish list of how these waveforms would look. And I'm going to propose I want something somewhat like this. And I'm not incredibly precise here, but I want to draw out a few characteristics of what I would like if I could shape these arbitrarily. First, I made them kind of trapezoidal. And the reason I want that is I like this flat top that gives me some amount of charge, some amount of volt seconds that I need in order to, on my ladder passives, influence the amount of current I need out of an inductor, influence the amount of voltage I need on a cap. So I need total charge, total volt seconds. The trapezoidal top, I can get that without very high peak stresses that I get if these waveforms were purely sinusoidal or triangular or anything more peaky. Okay. So I like that trapezoidal shape because it limits my peak, limit my RMS stresses to get whatever I need out of an average value on these waveforms. Okay. And then here I have no overlap at all between V and I. And really more importantly, with the way I've drawn these, I have relatively low slopes in my change in I, change in V at their switching transition. And those low slopes are going to help me with some of these things that I was drawing out in the previous slide. So things like sudden change in parasitic inductance is going to be mitigated if I have a very small slope in my change in current. Things like DVDT induced noise during my switching is going to be reduced if I have very slow DVDT at that switching instant. And things like how precise my timing is on my modulator. Can I exactly time out at the right switching instant? Well, I'm going to be less sensitive to errors in my timing if my waveforms are changing very slowly right around that switching instant. Okay. So if I could synthesize some ideal converter, this is kind of what I'd like to have as waveforms on my transistor, in order to give me the best promise for moving towards high switching frequency with reasonable conduction and switching loss. Okay. So that's our design goal. Okay. So with that in mind, we're going to look at things beyond the ZVS quasi-square wave type switching that we've looked at extensively in the course so far and see relative to what we want, relative to the types of loss mechanisms we know exist, how can I go even further? Okay. So we're looking at now moving switching frequencies higher than what would have been feasible with our ZVS quasi-square wave. So we want to keep going where parasitic inductances are significant. How do we continue pushing up? So we're beginning with a little bit from chapter 20 of the book. Chapter 20 is talking about this general technique of resonant switches. The ZVS quasi-square wave is one of them. Chapter 20 goes through and spends a lot of time on this zero current switching quasi-resonant switch. I'm going to leave the derivation there to the book, and we're going to instead look at the zero voltage switching quasi-resonant switch. The results are put in the book, but the derivation is not. We'll do the derivation here in lecture. So the general idea that the book goes through is this resonant switch concept, which is translating a typical PWM converter into some form of soft switching PWM converter, and motivating this by saying, if I can take my switching cell out of the converter and examine that switching cell on its own, I can look at modifying my two switches with resonant elements in a way that it can be incorporated into any parent PWM topology, and the analysis remains the same. So the way this works is by noting what is the high frequency behavior of really switches in any of my parents' apologies. So I've got a buck boost, and chook here. And I'm going to look at the high frequency behavior of these converters. So for my buck, I have an input voltage VG, and then at the output, I have a big CF, a big LF. I'm putting subscript F to know this is a filter element. This is something that's meant to be DC in its state. So DC current through my inductor, DC voltage on my capacitor. So if I look at and around the switching frequency, what's going to happen? My DC source has zero AC component, so it becomes a short. My inductor is some large filter element, so it's going to have high impedance. It's going to go to an open. My CF is going to become a short up near the switching frequency. And what I get is something that looks like this. I've got my active switch Q and my diode effectively in parallel. Going through with the boost, I'd have an open and a short for the output capacitor. Buck boost, open here, short, chook, open, short, open. So all four of these end up looking like this basic switch cell, just two devices in parallel when I look at high frequency. So this is for your typical PWM converter. Now if I start looking at the ZVS quasi-square wave type operation that we've looked at for at least three of these. So for the buck, it was in lecture 20. For the boost, kind of have lectures 1 through 3, we looked at a quasi-square wave boost. Buck boost was in homework 3 or 4, did the quasi-square wave buck boost, and chook we haven't done yet, but we've looked at all of these. And the basic idea of operation is we wanted to incorporate parallel capacitance from the FET and the diode, and we wanted to replace this LF with instead a small resonant inductor. Wow, ripple on that could get a CVF. Okay. So now when I look at my so-called high frequency behavior at or near the switching frequency, these resonant elements stay in. They're not filter elements. They don't look like some huge impedance or some zero impedance. My CF still does go to a short. My input source still does go to a short. Those should still have very small components at high frequency, but these resonant elements stick in. If I redraw this, it's going to look like some CR that's the parallel capacitance of all these CR1 and CR2. And then my resonant inductor, which is now, because I shorted the output at high frequency, placed right here. Okay. When I look at the boost, the LR and these caps, my output shorted and my input shorted. And again, looks like this, buck boost, this LR. And then for the chook, I leave this C as a filter element, incorporate these capacitance, and then have one, the other, or both of my two inductors becoming resonant inductors. I still end up with something that looks like this. Okay. So what we've looked at, this EVS quasi square wave, where my waveforms look more or less like the PWM case, but with resonant transitions, I can reduce the switch cell down to something that looks like this. Okay. I effectively incorporate the shunt capacitance of the switch, which is the CR in parallel with my two switches, and I put this shunt inductance that's going to resonate with it and allow me to get zero voltage switching. Okay. So this is one of really a class of four different resonant switch converters. And they're divided out by the type of waveforms and what sort of soft switching I get. So I have ZVS and ZCS, and then I have quasi square wave, what's called quasi resonant. Okay. Quasi square wave, ZVS, what we've looked at, where I alter so that my waveforms look like resonance, flat, resonance. Okay. Quasi resonant is going to look like a portion of a sinusoid in my waveforms. Okay. Higher peak stresses, but merits in lower slopes at the switching instances. Okay. On my grid here, quasi square wave we just looked at for ZVS. The idea was I'm integrating the shunt capacitance into the circuit operation and ensuring ZVS on it by adding a resonant inductor here in parallel. It's going to get me the ZVS. For my other two, for quasi-resonant ZVS, I'm again going to integrate the shunt capacitance because I'm trying to get ZVS. So that's what I want to incorporate into circuit operation. The difference is going to be that instead of the shunt inductance, I'm incorporating some series inductance in the power loop between the two FETs, or two switching devices. I may not have mentioned this explicitly as on a previous slide. Q and D are noting the active and non-active switch. Doesn't necessarily mean FET and diode. Could be FET and synchronous FET, but this is the one that I'm have to control. This one could be a diode or a FET, depending on my implementation. That's my ZVS quasi-resonant switch cell. Just as I did on the previous slide, I could create any of the basic topologies with this type of switch cell, and I'd have similar behaviors. In the next couple of slides, we'll analyze this using state plane analysis and show what the behavior is of this type of switch cell. Before we do that, I want to just draw these ZCS switch cells. So the ZCS is focused on, in both cases, this series inductance with the FET. That's the main parasitic I'm trying to integrate into operation. If I'm worried about that inductance, I want a zero current switch, but I don't have energy in that when I turn this switch off. About before. For quasi square wave, I'm going to add a capacitor here to resonate with that inductor. For quasi resonant, I'm going to add one here. And these constitute really the four ways that I can get any type of soft switching behavior with single resonance and two switches. Okay. So single resonance, meaning it's going to be well suited to state plane analysis, but I've got really one resonant frequency, one state plane that I can analyze this whole thing on. Okay. Multi-resonance we will look at later. Okay. So examining closer this ZVS quasi-resonant switch cell, I'm going to just do an example of it in a buck. The fundamental analysis, what we sketch on the state plane, these things will be general to any sort of topology we put it in. Choosing a buck because it's the simplest. So what I've got is this CR, which is the parallel capacitance of the MOSFET, and I insert or use my inherent parasitic series inductance with that MOSFET in my resonant operation. L here is still LF, C out is CF. These are large filter elements that we're going to assume maintain constant current. The current here should be IL, voltage here should be V. And I'm going to look at the waveforms of my two resonant elements. I'm going to look at I sub LR, V sub CR as this thing operates. And I'm going to have four subintervals per switching period. I'll label them 1, 2, 3, 4. And examine the operation. I'm going to pick how this thing starts. I'm going to say I'm starting with the MOSFET on. The MOSFET is on. V sub CR must be zero. And I've steadied out to a point where the full output current is flowing through that MOSFET. So I sub LR is going to be capital IL. So here's where I stand at the start of the switching period, and the first thing I'm going to do is shut the MOSFET off. When I shut that MOSFET off, initially the diode's off, and it's not going to turn on until I bring the switch down or force some current coming up through the diode. So the circuit that I'm left with in this subinterval is going to be EG. My MOSFET is shut off, so I have CR, LR, and then my filter element, which is going to look like a DC current source IL. Okay. So as long as this circuit remains true, I know that the current is going to stay locked at IL, because I have a single loop here and a current source in it. V sub CR, the voltage on this cap, well, it's got IL going through it, so this voltage is going to rise at a rate of IL over CR. Okay. I begin rising the slope here, IL over CR, and this period is going to continue until my diode turns on. That's going to happen here when CR is significantly high enough of a voltage such that I get 0 volts across the diode and it turns on. So the diode voltage is VG minus VCR minus whatever voltage I have on LR, right? Just looking around that loop. What's the voltage on LR if I have a DC current flowing through it? Must be zero. So this is going to happen when VCR reaches VG. Okay. When my FET is locking the full input voltage VG, I'll have enough of a drop to turn that diode on, and it'll begin taking over the output current. So when that diode turns on, it's going to pop in and it's going to short out this output current. What I'm going to be left with in subinterval 2, going to be a resonant circuit. My diode has now shorted out the output current. I have effectively just a series LC resonance biased by VG and with these initial conditions. Okay. Initial condition, the inductor current is flowing down, positive negative on my capacitor voltage is going to initially cause capacitor voltage to increase, inductor current to decrease. So I'm going to resonate here, and I'm going to look something like this in my waveforms. Okay. this resonance is going to continue until the voltage on CR tries to go negative. At that point, either I turn on the FET, and if my timing is good, that's what I'd like to do to avoid body diode conduction. If I don't turn on the channel of that transistor, that effective switch is going to turn on anyway due to the body diode, and it's going to clamp the voltage VCR at zero. Right? Once that FET turns on, I effectively have a short CR, my diode is still on, so my circuit looks like this. I've got a fixed voltage across my resonant inductor. I'm going to have my current ramp up the rate here of VG over LR. My FET remains on. And that's going to continue up until my ILR takes over all of the output current, at which point the diode can shut off. And I'm back to where I started. Okay, so to summarize here, I'm just write what is conducting during each of these intervals. During interval one, I have nothing conducting. Interval two, I have my diode. Interval three, the diode and the FET. Interval four, just the FET. This. Really only have one breakpoint in this of interest, this current right here. I'm going to call minus I2. I'm going to use that in my state plane analysis in a moment. Otherwise, all of my currents and voltages are defined. Okay, so if you buy it and this is the mode of operation, this is what this thing's going to do if I plug it in and start switching it. What's good and what's bad about this thing? So, good stuff. One, I've incorporated kind of the two dominant parasitics of my MOSFET. I have both L and C parasitics of my FET incorporated. By incorporated, I mean I'm kind of zero voltage switching that CR, and I've got low ramp rates on my current, so I should mitigate losses due to both of those elements. The other good thing, contrary to what we saw previously with quasi-square wave zero voltage switching converters, is that my IP is equal to IL. I have comparable current stresses to what I got in my original PWM case where I was hard switching. So I don't have this issue of my current has to ramp up to twice IL and I have much higher current stresses. Okay. The flip side, issues. No diode parasitics are integrated. In my ZVS PWM converter where I neglected this series inductance, my diode capacitance was effectively in parallel with my MOSFET capacitance, and I kind of got them both for free. Now, if I've got some significant inductance in that loop, diode capacitance is no longer in parallel with the MOSFET capacitance. If this capacitance is significant, I now have a multi-resonant situation where that inductor can resonate with this cap or that cap at different resonant frequencies during different portions of the switching period. So if my diode's more or less ideal, this is great. The diode's very non-ideal. This might not be the correct choice for topology. And then two, my peak voltage on the MOSFET is much greater than the PWM case. My original PWM case, my MOSFET had the block BG when the diode was on. Now that's where I begin my resonance. I'm going to resonate up above that 1.5, 2, 3 times higher. I have much higher voltage stresses. I got benefit in terms of current stresses, hurt me in terms of voltage stresses, just the dual of the quasi square wave, where I had good voltage stresses, bad current stresses in that case. Okay. So, taking these waveforms, and I want to solve out the operation of the converter, I'm going to do that using state plane analysis. I'm going to plot on my MCR versus JLR axes. I'm going to use V base is equal to VG, and R naught is equal to root LR by CR. I base is VG over R naught as normal. Looking at my operation, my starting point somewhere here at a current of JL and a voltage on the FET of 0. I shut off the FET, my voltage ramped up linearly until it reached VG, which is going to be a normalized value of 1. At that point, I began my resonant interval, which resonated around to achieve 0 voltage switching back at 0 volts on the FET. I'm going to name this angle beta. This is my minus J2. My radius here, R2 is JL. This was subinterval 1, 2, and then subinterval 3, I had a constant voltage source across an inductor. And that ramped me back up to my starting point where I sat in subinterval 4 until I turned the FET off again. So this is my state plane. I'm going to go through and solve this. We're all experts in this now, so we can do so quite quickly. So subinterval 1 was this constant current ramping across the capacitor. I'm going to have IL over CR times T1 is equal to VG. When I normalize that, what I'm going to get is beta 1 is equal to 1 over JL. Subinterval 2 is my resonant subinterval. I'm going to get two equations out of it for relating my radii. I already applied part of it. R2 is JL. And that's equal to down here, square root of J2 plus 1 squared. I'm going to solve that in terms of J2. Say J2 is equal to root JL squared minus 1. My angle during that subinterval, theta, is going to be pi for the first 180 degrees. And I'm going to write it as the arc sine of this triangle here. This will look like pi plus sine inverse of 1 over JL. I also, as I'm looking through this subinterval, my resonant subinterval, can talk about what my ZVS condition is. So resonate all the way back down to 0 on the MCR axis. I need this radius to be greater than a distance 1, R2 greater than 1, or JL greater than or equal to 1. Okay. Subinterval three, again, another linear ramping subinterval. This looks like BG over L R times T3 is equal to I2 plus IL. When I normalize that, what I'm going to get is theta 3 J2 plus JL. And then my last subinterval 4, I don't get anything from the state plane because I'm just sitting at a single point. So what I really get is just that this is going to be the rest of my period. So 2 pi over S is theta 1 plus beta plus theta 3 plus theta 4. Relate my complete switching period to the sum of the four switching subintervals. Okay. I'm out of time for today's lecture, so we'll pick up next class, apply the averaging step, integrate these equations, and then look at the behavior of this ZVS quasi-resonant converter. Okay. Good luck. Let me know if you have any issues with your layout. Make sure to get those in ASAP for review from Sierra. So you can, by Wednesday, be sure to have something that's passed.